There are fewer than 30 men in the world qualified to drive Formula One. A mere half dozen, perhaps, to win. At this moment, I'm inclined to think you're not one of them.
No, you want to.
Keep up the good work, Stephen, and there you have it. There you go.
Hello, this is Desiree for F1Weekly.com. I'm your in-depth correspondent.
Let's go. Qualifying, Steve.
Welcome to F1Weekly.com. My name is Clark Rogers. I'm the host of the program. I'll be joined by Steve Faub, my co-host. Nasser Hamid will be bringing us Motorsports Mondial in the second part of the program. This is podcast number 524, September 1st, 2011. Stephen?
This F1Weekly podcast is brought to you by Google Ads. Google Ads for all your needs. Click on them, you know you want to.
Thank you, Stephen. On today's program, Senna doing what Heidfeld couldn't. Turkey off the 2012 calendar. Le Grand Prix de France is on its way back, I think. And, of course, Motorsports Mondial with Nasser Hamid, the king of Karachi himself. Steve, welcome to the studio. How are you?
Wonderful, Mr. Rogers, and yourself?
I'm just wonderful. You know, we've got Monza coming up. It's the midweek program. We've got Nasser going on assignment to South America, where we know he's going to bring in the goods.
Get some kahunas. Good South American interviews.
There's so many possibilities. Jose Maria. I mean, we're talking the big guns here, and when Nasser goes out, we know conquests is inevitable.
Historical significance.
Absolutely, absolutely. But there you have it. Of course, the big news from Renault is apparently Senna was just so charming and charismatic that he's just turned the whole garage upside down with his charm, his smile, what Heidfeld couldn't do. And I find this interesting. Eric Boullier's come down, even though, you know, the dismal 13th place after the race wasn't, you know, I mean, Heidfeld could have produced that or even bettered it. But still, they are really pumped up about Bruno Senna.
Well, I think it's an energy issue. What you've done is you've kind of got a kid who's really still hungry and wants to be a Formula One driver, and you know he obviously has personality, something that Nick Heidfeld apparently does not, and it can make a huge difference. You've talked many a time about how Fernando Alonso can kind of galvanize a team towards the goal, and I think that Bruno may also have some of those tools in his kit bag to bring a team together and move them in the right direction.
And this is something that people often forget, that it's not just your driving capabilities, it's the package you bring to a team. And that includes enthusiasm and, like you said, a hunger. And, of course, your technical input with the engineers, your reportage with everybody is so critical to a team. And definitely Nick Heidfeld didn't have that. And, you know, I don't know, he seemed like a nice guy, but
it probably is, but maybe he isn't, you know, quick with praise, isn't, you know, kind of that outgoing, exuberant type of individual. He's probably more get to work, be a...
You mean like me, Steven?
Exactly.
No, that's very, very true. And especially when you're in the twilight of your Formula One career, yet to win a Grand Prix, a number of great podiums, certainly, but still, I'm sure you become a bit grumpy.
A little bitter. You know, that's why I was seeing Lotus talking about signing Trulli again. I'm like going, why? You've got the guy who literally has the worst sound bites of any driver on the grid about what his team's going to be able to do that week. There's never any positive, optimistic spin to what he says. It's like, we'd be lucky to outpace Virgin, you know? Come on.
No, I agree. And obviously, there's a lot of things we don't know about that's in the background, and I presume that Yarno truly is driving for free. Because, I mean, come on. I like Yarno truly. Oh, he was always been a good qualifier.
Yeah. Maybe he's getting free pizza from Fisichella that he's bringing to the garage.
You know, I don't know, but with all the young drivers out there, especially after this GP2 season, there's certainly a lot of young guns out there that could bring you some excitement. But on the other hand, teams want money, or they want free drivers.
Free experience.
Free experience. So, you know, Yarno truly, you know, maybe he does have that great rapport with his engineers that we don't know about.
Right. He always seems kind of grumpy when he's talking to the press. And maybe that's just his way with the press.
Exactly.
And speaking of Senna, ultimately, the two drivers are the captain and co-captain of the team, so to speak.
Certainly.
And so their leadership is very important, I think, to the dynamic.
Exactly. And the sad thing is, you know, Heidfeld is taking court action against Renault F1 for being released early, which is not going to help his career anything.
No, and what does how does that ingratiate him with the team? He's basically just creating drama in a situation where, obviously, the only reason I could see him taking court action is if Renault said, "You're fired, and we're not paying you the rest
hard to believe.
The remaining 8 races." Then I could see him filing suit. But if they said, "Sorry, we're putting someone else in the car," that's really not his choice. You know, unless he had it written into his contract that he gets to sit in the car all season, which I would almost guarantee he does not, then I see really no grounds for his suit.
Not only that, but if you've been in F1 for a little while, it's pretty much a race-by-race career. I mean, the team always has the option of putting another driver in there. Ask Karun Chandhuk and Yarno Trulli.
Yeah, you knew there are probably 4 guys on the grid who have it written into their contract that their seats are solid, and that would be Fernando, Lewis, Sebastian, and maybe Jenson Button.
I'll throw in Schumacher.
You'll throw Michael away, too. Michael walks away when Michael wants to walk away.
Yes.
You've got to get Montezemolo to go talk to him if you want him to leave.
Exactly. So there you have it. But still, I would think that Nick Heidfeld would try to be a little more cordial in his exit from Formula One, because he's still in his late 30s, and he's going to be seeking drives in, like you always say, DTM, BTCC, and perhaps even go across the pond to the IRL. And you certainly don't want to leave a wake of looting and burning.
Yeah, well, you know, go to NASCAR. They seem to be the new litigation kings. So.
That's true, and they pay well.
Exactly.
So I think that's great. Anyway, let's move on. Turkish Grand Prix, Exne, Zilchne, Exito. No Turkish Grand Prix, which is sad because that was a great Grand Prix. But on the other hand, in these economic times, empty stands.
Yeah, wasn't Bernie running that track, though? I'm like going, you'd think that he would know how to promote a race if anybody did.
Well, he does, but the problem is, even with promotion, if people don't have the $500 million per ticket to go, it's expensive.
Yeah, ultimately, especially in some place, they should be selling, on race day, $5 tickets to grandstands if you aren't sold out.
I agree. Any kind of income is positive income.
Yeah, because you're going to get concessions. You're going to, you know, it's,
I agree. You know, the kebabs do sell well there.
Yeah, among other things.
So, no, that's a sad story because the Turkish Grand Prix, it's a great track.
It's one of the most fun to watch a race on because there are a couple of good spots for overtaking. That 3 apex high-speed corner is always fun to watch people going around.
And it's been on the calendar since 2005. It's been on there for quite a while.
Only 6 years, but...
Well, still, it's a sad state of affairs, and but hey, we haven't had a Grand Prix de France in a while, so tough!
Yeah, well, we're getting a Grand Prix de USA next year, too, so...
Well, it's exciting, so let's go through it, Stephen. March 18th, we have the Australian Grand Prix. March 25th, Malaysian Grand Prix. April 15th, Chinese Grand Prix. Then Bahrain comes on April 22nd. The Spanish Grand Prix comes on May 13th, and we end on May 27th at Monaco. Then June 10th, we go to Canada, Then we go back to Europe for the European Grand Prix on the 24th. The 8th of July is the British Grand Prix at Silverstone. 22nd of July, we've got the German Grand Prix. At the end of the month of July, on the 29th, we have the Hungarian Grand Prix. Then early September 2nd, we have the Belgian Grand Prix at Spa. Then we go over to Monza on the 9th. On the 23rd, we go to Singapore. Then in October 7th, the Japanese Grand Prix. The 14th of October is the Korean Grand Prix, one of your favorites, Stephen.
I'll be interested to see what that track's like in the dry this year, hopefully.
The 28th of October is the Indian Grand Prix, which is going to be fascinating. 4th of November, we've got Abu Dhabi. Then from Abu Dhabi, they go all the way back to North America for the United States Grand Prix at Austin, Texas. That's going to be on the 18th of November, and we end the season in Brazil on the 25th of November.
Well, it's going to be a brutal schedule for the teams. That whole second half is in Asia.
Yeah, very brutal.
And second then you have to go across the globe to the States and then to Brazil.
Yeah, they cross the Pacific, basically, go to U.S. and then down south. So, wow, 20 races. It's pretty exciting, though.
Yeah, it's pretty much, sell your apartment after the vacation break in August because you're not getting back to your house till December.
Yeah. That's a tough break. But still, I think I'm glad to see that the U.S. Grand Prix will be in November.
Yeah, much better.
A lot of heat off the F1 Weekly staff.
Oh, yeah. Not only that, but it also takes a lot of heat off of anybody at that race.
Yeah, it would be brutal. And they did the same thing with the Indian Grand Prix moving it into April. No, away from April, excuse me.
Yeah.
Let's go back to the schedule. October. The Indian Grand Prix will be in October. So, a lot of, this is smart thinking. The U.S. Grand Prix in June right after Canada makes logistical sense, but certainly not comfort.
June in Texas, not a, especially if you take a year like this, they basically ran from June to August, the middle of August, with 100 plus days.
Yeah, we're talking, 39, 40 degrees centigrade.
Yeah. Brutally hot.
Yes,
this past year.
And to be honest with you, with those kind of temperatures, I would very honestly not be interested in going. Because we can't afford an air-conditioned box next to Bernie.
No. And when it got warm in Indianapolis.
It was warm.
But it's not like the heat that you and I are used to here in California where, it's maybe 95, but the humidity's typically sub 30%. When you get to 100 degrees with even 50% humidity, it's just... It's like
heavy.
Walking around in a sauna.
It's heavy, and it's not comfortable.
No.
So I'm glad they did that. Let's move on to Jenson Button. Of course, I was surprised to hear this, that he still hasn't signed a contract for next year. After all that passing, I would have thought...
that McLaren would have already snapped him up, just because, he is a first-rate driver, and... I don't believe they're paying him an exorbitant salary necessarily, but he's racing as well. He's a lot easier in the car than Lewis is.
I agree completely. But still, he has not confirmed a drive at McLaren for next year, and he's just hoping. He says that it's up to the team as when they approach me. But for me, I'm the happiest I've been with the car. The car I really like, and the direction we've taken with the car is really wonderful. I think McLaren is the most beautiful team in the world.
The car.
So, I don't blame him for that. So I'm sure he'll be signed.
Yeah.
Who else is going to go?
Yeah, the only thing I can see is picking up one of the new kids coming out of GP2. And frankly, it doesn't really make any sense. If they want to compete for the championship, especially in this day and age, you really have got to have two pretty good drivers, especially if you're looking to get manufacturer's championship. Because it's so easy, especially if you've got Lewis in your other car.
Well, I was thinking, alongside Lewis Hamilton, I was thinking Rubens Barrichello.
Sure, why not? Keep him in the sport.
Forever.
Nick Heidfeld.
And ever. So, there you have it. Pastor Maldonado, he's pretty pumped up. His name has been in the limelight. And don't forget, any publicity, including bad publicity, is good publicity. And, you know, I've talked more about Pastor Maldonado in the last few weeks than ever. So good for him. He's pretty pumped up, even though he thinks Lewis Hamilton is a loser.
You called him a loser?
I didn't.
Or just a jerk?
Well, I might have substituted a few words. But he says, quote, "I'm not going to relax. I'm a fighter. On although the championship, I've been fighting and pushing so hard with the team to improve the car, to do every race better and better. Unfortunately, we did not have a strong car, especially in the beginning of the championship, which cost me a lot of experience. But I think I feel more confident in the team, the mechanics, engineers, the car, the tracks, and even myself, as long as Lewis Hamilton stays away from me." So Pastor Maldonado, he's, you know, you can't blame him for that. Big loss in the racing world, of course. Martin Hines dying last week of cancer at the age of 64. And this is a sad thing. He was outstanding. Everybody knew this man from his outstanding skills in the karting world, of course. He's the founder of Zipkart and a multiple British, European, world, and endurance karting champion. And of course, people like Ayrton Senna couldn't beat him. He was that good.
Yeah.
And he helped a lot of people. He was called the karting guru, basically. And,
yeah.
And I have to admit, one of my favorite interviews of all time, and this is an old interview, but still, it's still one of my top tens, and that's Nasser Hamid interviewing Martin Hines, I believe, in Belgium. I think it was at Charleville, but I'm not sure. Nas could talk about that in the Motorsports Mondial segment. But still, an outstanding talent and a huge loss to the motorsports community. So we'll see what Nas has to say about that. Anyway, we're going to take a quick break, and we're going to come back with Motorsports Mondial after this brief message from Bell Auto Care.
Do you own a European or Japanese vehicle and live in the New York tri-state area? Then I want to tell you about Bell Auto Care. Bell Auto Care is a Bosch authorized repair shop with over 35 years of dedication in providing honest, friendly, and up-to-date repair and preventative maintenance to vehicles like yours and mine. Not only is this the shop in the New York area to take your European or Japanese car, they are F1 and MotoGP enthusiasts as well. So go to bellautocare.com to check out their special deals, F1 and MotoGP news, or for more information, and ring their bell to care for your car.
Welcome back to F1Weekly.com. Clark Rogers here, your host. And now, as we spin the globe and go around the world with Motorsports Mondial and the Swami, the guru himself, Nasser Hamid.
Greetings and racing regards. Today we have motor racing from the hills in the Ardennes Forest to the hills of Napa Valley. From Red Bull Ring in Austria to the Bull Ring that is Bristol, Tennessee, which I believe is your favorite track.
Oh, one of my favorites for sure.
Yes.
The shorter the better.
Oh yeah, have you seen the grandstands there?
Yeah.
They go sky high and they were jam packed.
Of course, and the hot dogs were a flowing.
Yes. 99, buy one, get three free.
Thank you, sir.
Yes, sir. We start with F1 and the finger is back. If one goes to the official website of Formula One and click on results, and you know you want to, you will see Sebastian Vettel has done 12 races so far this season, 9 of them from pole position, including 4 in a row to start the season. So he's having a season that you would want none to have. And who can blame you for that? I see the blue cap is back.
It's the F1 Weekly cap, Nasser.
I like it. Surprisingly, the only race he was not on the front row was his home race, which was really, really surprising. And again, the only race he did not finish in the top two was the German Grand Prix, where he had his worst result of the season, 4th. Amazing, huh?
It's the German pressure.
Yes. 7 wins and a lead of over 90 points. That's more than 3 full race wins over teammate Mark Webber, who has not won a race since Hungary last year. I think the race I was looking at the result was August 1st, 2010. So he's gone over a year with that car without a win. That is
the
not
cage.
I don't think there's no cage rattling there.
Yeah, yeah. The cage was open and the meerkat has jumped out. Bastian is looking real good. Oh, more bad news for you, sir. Bastian is looking real good to replace Nando as the youngest double world champion. I can't help it.
But Vettel's going to do it with a Renault anyway, so
it's, yeah,
it's a coin flip.
But he's not very much.
He's still driving a Renault.
So you're going to start, you know, salivating about muy mucho hombre de Alemania?
Not necessarily, but still. If it's done with Renault power, I'm not too bummed out.
That's good. Vettel has won 10 of the last 16 races, F1 races. Very possible he may end the season with a dozen victories. And that 10 could have been easily 11 had he not had that engine failure in Korea.
What's your point?
I'm just saying 11 victories out of 16 is very good.
Was the humidity.
Yes. That race is coming up soon again, right?
Korea?
Yeah.
It's coming.
I'd like to see how the track is and dry weather conditions.
You got your kimchi put together?
Yeah, exactly. And let's see if the Love Hotel prices have increased from $50 to $75.
I would count on it.
Yeah. Lewis Hamilton. Wow. As Andy Williams would say in a song, "Where Do I Begin?" You know that song from Love Story?
One of my favorites.
Absolutely. China 2007, you know, then Japan. Remember when at the start he was battling with, I think, Raikkonen, and then both went off, and Kubica took the lead. And as soon as Kubica took the lead, and there was a little mayhem, and then I saw Nando in second, I said, Nando is going to win this race. And that was a very impressive win. Okay, then Mr. Hamilton tangles with Massa at Monza on before the first lap was even half over. Then Weber in Singapore, and now clash with Kobayashi. At least the man is trying and hustling. But, you know, this season, there was no way he was going to win the championship or anybody but Sebastian Vettel. So he can just, you know,
hit cars.
Put it down to experience, huh?
No, I think Lewis Hamilton is going to reflect back on all this and become a better driver.
Well, one would hope so. But the thing is, you know, like his dad said, whatever his shortcomings are, he still won a championship with them. So,
and I think Kimi Räikkönen says the same thing.
Yeah, well, Kimi Räikkönen lost interest in motor racing and winning. But, you know, if you put Lewis Hamilton in Sebastian Vettel's team, I would love that cage rattling. Not saying he's going to beat him, but I think it's going to be dog-eat-dog war.
And I think it would be a little more tense.
It's going to be brutal. It's going to be like Rossi and, what's his name, Lorenzo at Yamaha. They had a Chinese war. They wouldn't talk to each other.
It's the best. And that's what I want.
Cutthroat competition.
Yeah, and this lovey-dovey stuff is just not for me.
No. Lovey-dovey is not good. You know, having Alonso with Massa, and that doesn't work.
I agree.
I would like to see Alonso and Vettel also. Just to
see. That would be good, too.
Yeah. Who do you think will be rattling whose cage?
Oh, you know, Fernando could take care of it.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay. I believe you. Nico Rosberg, smoking on the grid and for the first three laps. Hope we see him in a competitive car soon. It will be interesting to see him go head-to-head with his teammate when they can... And you know he has a teammate who has won a race or two.
I've heard of him.
Yeah. When they can battle for victories. Question will be, will they call him and tell him to save fuel while he's heading for a win? What's going on there? Is he too hard on the equipment or the engine?
I'm not sure, but I found it intriguing. 20 years of Schumacher, and all of a sudden he needs to save fuel.
Yeah, well, you know, I'll tell you, man, 20 years of motor racing and Formula One, and that I still say to this day that his performance, Michael Schumacher's in that qualifying, to me has remained more impressive than any of his wins, except for the Spain 2006, which was his first Ferrari win, in which I've never seen the race, but I've heard about it. But then again, the quality of competition he had, I still like the qualifying was incredible. I remember when I got that news, you know, they were mentioning, I was very, very impressed. It was a good car. It was not, you know, that car, De Chazares almost won the Belgian Grand Prix with that car, and it set the fastest lap race before. But still, to come in from sports car racing, nobody, and start cage rattling from day one.
Yeah, it's pretty impressive.
I just love that. Now we move on to Hapidos and lay congratulations to Romain Grosjean on winning the championship after a smart race to third place in Saturday's feature race won by Christian Fittoris of Germany. And Romain Grosjean really drove a smart. This is how you win championship. You know, there was no need to. This is something Lewis Hamilton should have done in Brazil 2007. Instead of trying to pass Nando, he should have just followed him all race long and said, ha, 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 you are second, I am third, but I am the champion. But did not happen.
Yeah, well, he should have come in for tires 5 laps sooner in China, too.
that was really, really bad. But I think that was more of the team managing his race at that time. But these things happen. And Romain Grosjean now has won pretty much every series he has, championship in every series he has gone in. That's very impressive. I wish him well. I would like to see him get a fair shot in Formula One and see how far he can go. But you know how things are in Formula One. In other F1 news, you already mentioned no more Turkish Delight for Istanbul as the Turkish Grand Prix is removed in the final version of the 2012 calendar. Turkey gone, Texas in. And I am, you know, very disappointed. This is a fantastic track. One of the few Telke tracks that is really, really nice. And I feel bad for the nation, you know, because they spent so much money. If you add the cost of building this track, maintaining, and the fees they have paid, it's got to be like, $600,000 or something. Close to coming up to $1 billion of investment. And they don't do a lot of races there. Mm-hmm. I know initially they did a DTM race, and I think a MotoGP went there or somewhere. And now it's
nothing.
Now it will be the Tofas Grand Prix. You know what Tofas is?
No, I don't.
It's that thing. That's the name of the Fiat subsidiary in Turkey that built. I think it's Tofas. Yeah, the from F1 to Tofas. Welcome to the world of Bernie Ecclestone. Anyway, going back to the Hapidos, Luca Filippi won the sprint race on Sunday, and going back to F1, you know, you mentioned about. Bruno Senna, very impressive in qualifying in next few races, especially if they're in the dry. We will see if he can rattle the Russian cage in races. But I'll tell you, this lovey-dovey the team is feeling about him. I met this kid twice. Once we did an interview with him. Second time was at Le Mans. I was so, so surprised with the name that he has and the pedigree and the background and the media attention. I have very rarely met a racing driver or even a person who's so humble and polite. I was very, very impressed. So I wish him all the best.
It's so much more energetic than the other young gun legacy, PK. Watching him, PK on the grid, was like pulling teeth. He was so dry, so dull, so dry. And Senna was on the speed broadcast and it, answering the questions quickly, politely. You know, giving a little insight as to, you know, what he's thinking, what he's trying to do. Such a better interview.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I was the first time when I met him, which was in 2008 Barcelona when he was in GP2. I mean, I was just like, wow, man. If you're carrying that name, I mean, you would expect some sort of a swagger or some sort of swagger. You know, just a very good upbringing. His mother was also there, and she doesn't speak English, so I did say hello to her. And I wish him all the best. Okay, and you know, I remember asking him at Le Mans in 2009, if I'm ever in Sao Paulo and you're in town, can we get together? He says, yeah, let me know if you're in town. I don't think, of course he won't be there because he'll be racing at Monza while I'm there. But, you know, hopefully we will connect sooner or later. But anyway, did you watch any of the Hapidos? Message for Mr. Interraptor. What happened to the link this time?
Which link?
You know, he normally puts on a link to the Hapidos.
I don't know.
On the forum. That's how I can watch these races.
People are busy, Nasser.
Yeah. But, you know, that's fine. This is not a complaint. Just a
I did not see
request
GP2.
Or a reminder. Yeah. And this company, you know, Telmex, there's a thing called Scuderia Telmex. You can go on their website. A couple of times I was able to see, but now for some reason they're not showing. Maybe Bernie figured out.
Bernie figured it out.
Bernie and Flavio.
Oh, yeah. Beautiful. Okay, now we go to Happy Tres. Valtteri Bottas of Finlandia won the opening race of the weekend. Impressive series debut win in race 2 for Richie Stanaway of New Zealand. This guy is really making a big name for himself. He's leading the German F3 Championship. And to come and win a race on your debut when there are drivers with very impressive credentials who are in their second year and have not even won one race in both seasons. So this is very good for him. So we'll see how far Richie goes. Now we come to IndyCars from Infineon Raceway, also known as Sears Point. Victory and podium for Penske drivers led by Will Power of Australia. Castro Neves was second and Ryan Briscoe third. Dario Franchitti was fourth. An announcement is expected soon that IndyCars will race in China, also known as China, next year. And they had Hoping Tang in this race, who is actually a Dutch national of Chinese origin.
For a Renault development driver.
Yeah, now he's with Gravity. Now, that's another kid. I mean, no chance in hell of making it to Formula One. We're talking strictly performance, not, you know, anything else. But it's a good idea to come here. And I mean, you look at Sato. I mean, he's doing here what he was doing there, crashing. And that's the way it is. And this weekend, the series IndyCars will be in the streets of Baltimore with Indy Lights and U.S. Formula 2000, where our friend Mr. Petri Suvanto has a very good chance of winning the championship. He's leading and has won quite a few races. And he's from Finland, of course. And if he wins the championship, he or whoever wins gets a free ride in Star Mazda. So there are some opportunities, you know, still in this tough environment where a very talented driver can latch on to a good deal.
Yeah, I see you're missing one really big piece of news from the Indy circuit.
Which one?
The big news.
The biggest news.
The winningest driver going to NASCAR.
Exactly, going to the hot dog.
You know, I'm so shocked.
Full time.
I'm still, you know, shell shocked.
I know, it was a tough one for you as well.
Yeah, and but you know, at F1 Weekly, we wish everybody all the best. And actually, they were talking on this on, I think, Dave Despin on Wind Tunnel. He had some guy from NASCAR, and he was talking about, you know, hey, whatever happened to winning and performance-driven drivers getting ahead? But you know, this is the age we live in, and let's see what happens.
It's all about
money. When you've been able to do for your sponsor what she's managed to do, or what has happened for her sponsor while she's been with him, I don't blame him.
No, and on a scale of 1 to 10, her marketing people have done a 14, 14-point job. I mean, incredible.
Yeah.
How much money
they went from, like, nobody as a web server provider to, like, number 3 in the world.
Yeah, even F1 Weekly signed up with them, right?
You're absolutely correct. Yeah.
But the money is flowing from us to them, not the other way around.
Correct.
Maybe you should do a lingerie post on a Traction Avant, do the spread eagle.
Yeah, I do have good legs.
Yeah, I'm sure you do. And tell the charming face.
Don't tell me.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, make a run to Victoria's Secret this
don't
weekend.
Don't give him any ideas.
Yeah, and maybe he'll say, you know, hey, this guy's pretty cool.
Just go get somebody in your wife's drawer or something.
Okay, let's move on to Indy, MotoGP. I was at Indy, second MotoGP race in the U.S. in a few months. Casey Stoner, Honda winner. Second, Danny Pedrosa, and American Ben Spies was third, so which was good. So, anything else you would like to talk about, but we're afraid to ask?
No, well, I'm always afraid to ask about a lot of things, but I heard you saw the Senna film.
Oh, yes. Thank you for bringing that up. And we're going to put the...
this is big.
We did not discuss this.
No. Okay, tell us about it in San Francisco.
Okay, with Peter Habish, who is the SFF1. They did a very good job. Our friend, of course, longtime friend. And as far as the movie is concerned, you know, what they have done is they have put together actual footage racing and this and that. So there are no actors or anything. Like the guy said, the only person who can play Senna is Senna. So for a gentleman who, this is not the director, Asif Kapadia, who was homie, but probably born and raised in England. He was not a racing person, but, you know, he's a movie director and all that. He has amassed very good knowledge. I was very impressed. And not just knowledge, but understanding and passion for the sport. And it's very interesting. And what he did, I was trying to get a 10-minute interview with him. It was late night and he was busy. So what I did, and it turned out to be very good, I recorded this Q&A that he was doing there. So a lot of people are asking questions, and it came out pretty decent, and I hope people enjoyed this thing. And what I really enjoyed, you know, apart from it bringing back a lot of memories, and, you know, it's interesting to see a race now being part of a very major history of motorsports that you watch with a couple of friends 5 in the morning 20 years ago or even more than in some cases. But what I really I've always been a behind the scene kind of a guy, you know. There are a lot of footage of interviews and press conferences and drivers meeting with Jean-Marie Blessed and other people. That to me was that to me is the heart of motorsports or any business, you know, people behind the scenes. And I know some people have expressed concern that it makes Senna look like a saint and it makes attempts to make Prost look bad. But I did not see the movie that way. I went to see History of Motorsports put together in a professional way. So I think if people should enjoy it, just for the information and the contents of it, and if they want to form opinion, of course, we cannot stop them from doing that. But it's worth seeing it. It's major history of motor racing, very well packaged, and I would recommend.
Excellent. So we'll have that coming up in a few minutes. And of course, you know, they're going to make a movie about Alain Prost eventually.
Oh, I certainly hope so.
Yeah, I heard Gérard Depardieu is going to be Alain Prost.
Not you?
No, I just don't have the hair.
All right. What's next? Is it playing, doing Danica?
It's possible.
Yeah, that'll be something.
That's going to be in the works.
Yeah. Hello, GoDaddy.
So, excellent. Thanks, Nas, for another outstanding Motorsports Mondial. And, of course, now, the Q&A with the Senna film director.
I can just start off by giving you a bit of the background on how the film came together. And then if you have some questions, please raise your hand. And if you do need to go, there are posters and things outside, some goodies. So, oh, hello. Oh, thank you. I'll put it down just for a second. See if I can get them to my wife. Long way away. Right, so the film started with the producer, James Gay Rees. Actually, before I even get into all of that, I just want to say how special it is for me to be here representing the crew, the people who made the film, to be here in San Francisco, to see it packed out, to see all of you here enjoying the film. Yeah, it's a really amazing feeling. We kept being told nobody cares about Formula One, no one cares about Senna here, you're never going to get a film released. And we never believed that. And you guys are the proof, you know, the proof has always been in the pudding. The audience have basically brought the film out in the US, and so we are really thankful to all of you guys. So, from all of us, thank you. I'll go back now. 2000, well, even before that, actually. James Gay Rees's dad used to work for JPS. He knew Senna when he was driving for the Lotus in the mid-80s. And he used to come home from work just saying, you know, I've just seen this guy. He's just different. He's the most intense, most charismatic, otherworldly driver or human being that I've ever come across. And James wasn't at that time particularly into Formula One. And so he heard that, but it, you know, kind of let it go. It wasn't until 2004, 10 years after his accident, that he read an article in the Times of London. And it was a reprint of Senna's obituary. And the journalist was not a Formula One journalist, but he kind of writes features. He's met many famous people all over the world, and he basically said there was the person that he remembers the most, Senna. He met him once, interviewed him once, and there was just something about the guy. Who he had this aura, he had an otherworldly presence, he had something about him. And it was a language that James's dad used to use. And so that's when he clicked and thought, maybe there's a movie here. And James is a drama producer, he's made feature films before. But he thought, maybe there's a film here to be made about Senna, but as a documentary. You know, his opinion was, if you make a film about Muhammad Ali, you get Muhammad Ali to play Muhammad Ali. If you make a film about Senna, Senna plays Senna. No one plays Senna better than Senna. So that was his instinct. He approached a company called Working Title Films, one of the biggest production companies in Europe. And they're kind of known for more films like Four Weddings and a Funeral and Notting Hill and stuff like that, United 93. Never made a documentary before. But Eric Fellner, who's the chairman, is a big car guy, big fan of motor racing, and he's tried to do dramas about Formula One before, but they never managed to get them together. So he liked the idea of doing a documentary. There were lots of moments of huge amounts of luck. There's something, you know, the Senna effect that kept happening during the process of making this film. And one of them happened very early on. One of the development executives at Working Title Films, James spoke to her, and she said, you've got to meet my husband. He's the world's biggest Senna fan. And that's Manish Pandey. He's the writer and the exec producer of the film. Manish is a surgeon. This is his first movie, but he is a huge Formula One and Senna fan. So James and Manish then got together, put together an outline, a 10-page document, and approached the Senna family in Sao Paulo flew over there, managed to pitch to the family, a 40-minute pitch. Everyone was in tears by the end of that meeting, and even though, you know, Matt had never met Senna before, Viviani Senna stood up, hugged him, and just said, "You really knew my brother, and, you know, we give you permission to make the film." So then they had to approach Bernie Eccleston. So to get the access to the footage, they had to approach Bernie. So the meeting was very short. Bernie walked in, didn't sit down. They pitched to him, and he said, "Okay, look, just give me all the money you've got, and I'll see what I can do." and they shook hands, and then they went away. And then it took 2 years, I think, to try and get all the contracts and agreements done with all the lawyers between Bernie, family, working title, Universal, everyone. Wow. 2 years of talking. At that point, they approached directors, and they spoke to quite a few directors, very well-known documentary directors. But for me, luckily, they're all busy, or they didn't get it, or they don't like Formula One, or who knows what. Whatever reason, no one else did it. And eventually they approached me. I've never made a documentary before, but I've made dramas. But I'm a big sport fan. I kind of was into sport long before I was into movies. And I remember this era, I was watching Formula One because it was on TV, it was on the BBC, it was on every other Sunday. So it was always on in the background. And I remember the rivalry, the kind of accidents in Japan were live on the radio in those days, they weren't really live on TV. So I remember listening to them on the radio when I was at college. I was watching Imola live. So I knew enough about the driver, and I knew how huge he was. I didn't really know too much about the man. And that was a big learning curve for me during the process of making the film. So I came on board, and there was an 8-month period when we were told we were going to make the film, but we actually didn't get the money through. So I had 8 months, I had an edit suite, but I couldn't hire an editor. So for 8 months, I was just looking at material on YouTube. This is kind of some weird thing of going to work by just sitting there watching YouTube for 8 months. And not really going to work because I wasn't being paid. But it was the point when the film really came together, because Manish has got lots of tapes at home. Manish and I actually cut a short film to try and see how could this work. On his laptop, we put a 10-minute short together. And that's the kind of light bulb moment. That's when I thought, well, actually, we don't need interviews. We don't need this to be like most documentaries with contemporary interviews. There's so much material. This sport exists through TV. Senna's so famous in Brazil, in Japan, everywhere, all over the world. Everywhere he goes, there's a camera. When he goes to work, there's a camera. Then we started seeing the drivers' meetings. There's a camera there. And, you know, they're not performing for the camera because these cameras are owned by Bernie. They're Formula One FOM cameramen. So they're trusted. So therefore, there's nobody worrying as a journalist in the corner there. And that's, you know, there's something special there about that particular guy in that particular sport at that moment in time, before public relations kicked in, before Twitter and Facebook and YouTube and any of that. They said what they thought, and they didn't have to worry about it because, you know, the cameramen are all part of the circus. So the idea was, let's just make the film entirely out of archive. That was my instinct. The first cut was 7 hours. Second cut was 5 hours long. We projected that one at the cinema in London, which I thought was quite cool. We had to bring lunch and everything. But we then cut it down to a tight 3 hours and then 2. And then eventually, you know, the thing is important, worth mentioning, the agreement with Bernie was for 40 minutes only of footage. The rest of the film was going to be interviews. So it's going to be a much more traditional talking heads kind of documentary. So we had an agreement for 40 minutes. I kept cutting this film entirely out of archive because I just thought this is the way to do it, because Senna, he carries a movie, you know, he's our lead character. I don't want interviews from people guessing what Senna was thinking when we can get Senna telling you what he was thinking. Yeah. Bit by bit, everybody on the team agreed it's the only way to make film. So it led to one thing: we had to go back to Bernie. We had to renegotiate our contract. Which, as you would know, he's very good at. He's quite happy to do that. Well, weirdly enough, he was this time. Something to do with Senna. I mean, by now we've got to know a lot of people within the Formula One circus. We've met Ron, we met Professor Sid Watkins, Frank Williams, Alain, everybody. We've spoken to everybody, we've done our research. People realised that because we'd spent so much time doing our research that we were not, you know, trying to do a job from the outside on the sport. We were actually fans, but we wanted to show what was actually happening at the time in the sport. And this is kind of considered by a lot of people one of the golden ages of Formula One. And Bernie said, okay. And he gave us a deal. He doubled the deal. Instead of 40 minutes, we were allowed to have 80, which is why we have the film that we've got now. So that kind of film was always going to come out in Brazil, in Japan, in the UK, and in Europe. But as I said at the start, we were always told, forget the US. No one cares. And one way it was good. There was no pressure. We just wanted to make a film. But we felt there is an audience there. We felt there are a lot of Europeans, there are a lot of Latinos, there are a lot of racing guys, there are a lot of fans, but maybe, you know, people just don't know they're out there. And so we pushed to bring the film to Sundance. in January, and we took it there with absolutely no PR, no publicity, no money behind us, no distribution, nothing at that time. And we just put a film there, and because we had no public relations, I think we had no way of publicising the film apart from Twitter and Facebook, and we just put the word out there. And there were six screenings, and within weeks they all sold out. Like, it was one of the first films to sell out totally. Did amazingly well. I'd say about a third of the audience were fans of Formula One that flew in from all over the states, drove from miles. The rest of the people had just heard about the film, knew nothing, didn't know the twists and turns, didn't know the roller coaster of Senna's life, didn't know the ending. And that was another key moment for us, was that maybe the plus point in the US is there are a lot of people who don't know Senna, therefore they don't know how amazing the story is. So the whole thing is a learning curve for them. Anyway, he won the World Cinema Audience Prize at Sundance. And that was really the beginning of the journey of the film coming out here. It showed at South by Southwest in Austin, it got standing ovation there. It won the audience prize at the LA Film Festival, and which brings us to last weekend, where it opened in New York and LA, and had the biggest opening for a documentary this year, and did great numbers, which means that then the people in the industry start noticing the film, which is a good thing. And here we are now, it's opening in San Francisco and another 10 or 12 cities across the US this weekend. So, yeah, this is a big deal. Next weekend, another 12 cities, so we're going to be hitting about 40 or 50 cities in the US by the end of the month, which is really great. So, as I said, thank you to you guys. You made it really happen. So, that's where we are. Now, that's the sum up. Any questions? Yeah, go ahead.
Amazing movie. Thanks for making it. Any chance you'll have the 3-hour cut available as a DVD?
We have a version that's going to be on a DVD, which is an hour longer. But it features, you know, all of the interviews that we did, it features those interviews. We've got an hour of Ron Prost, the journalist that we interviewed, all of them are featured in the film. So there is a version which is a DVD and a Blu-ray version, which is that. If the film does well enough, then, you know, the thing is actually go back to Burning. Once, maybe, I don't know if he's going to do it twice, but you never know. Maybe we'll be able to do some special screenings, some one-off screenings, hopefully, yeah.
Does the longer version include some of the personal life since that was a tumultuous driving career?
Well, does the longer version include more of his personal life is the question. The thing about, my job was to try and make it into a movie. Now, if I could show things, I put them in the film. If I can't show it, I just made a call to say we're not going to do the kind of gossipy version. Because there's plenty of those in Brazil. There's plenty of TV Globo specials with this girl, that person every week. They're out there, and we just decided not to do that. If there's footage, if there's a way of showing this is what's going on, fine. So in a way, there was a longer version which had more from, you know, Adriani and people like that, and other girlfriends that he had in the middle. But we didn't really get into that too much, just because, you know, they've all got their own TV shows. They're all very famous in Brazil. We spoke to the mum, we spoke to his mum, we spoke to Viviani, we spoke to Bianca, his niece, to Bruno. Bruno's the boy in the boat, driving the boat.
Oh, that's Bruno.
And on the jet ski at the end. Well, to be honest, they don't really want to talk about that stuff. You know. You're asking the question, you already know. Okay.
Yeah. What does Prost think of the movie?
Good question. So the people we had to show the film to, we felt, were the family. Were Ron, Bernie, Professor Sid Watkins, and Alan. Before the film came out, we tried to show it to all of these people. So last year during Monaco, when Bruno was racing, the family were all flying over from São Paulo. And so we hired a cinema in Cannes and showed it to the family, which was the most emotional screening, really, because even when he's winning, even when people normally laugh, they were all crying. That was really heavy. But at the end, Viviani did stand up and hug everyone and said, you know, you've got the right balance between the genius on the track and the humanity of the man off the track. Ron, that was pretty emotional. He came along through it a couple of times in London, cried a lot at the ending. You know, at the beginning, he's got his reputation of being a tough guy, but he's actually a softy underneath. And Senna is, you know, someone he really loved him. So that was another very emotional screening. Sid, that's really tough because Sid was there. You know, Sid's the first guy to go to him. He doesn't really watch it now. He's coming to the end of a lot of screenings, but it's too heavy. The two people we had trouble pinning down were Bernie and Prost. Bernie, in the end, came to at the London premiere. Came along. That was the first time he saw it, and really loved it, and said he didn't think he could make a film out of the footage. now he's probably quite happy because there's a lot of films in that footage that he's got in his archive. At that, we tried to set up lots of screenings. We offered to bring a print over to Paris, wherever he wanted, or Switzerland, or wherever. He was always too busy. And in the end, we know he's got a DVD, and what he said is he hasn't seen it yet.
Wow.
Yeah.
So there was a stark contrast in the footage you chose of the close-ups of Senna sitting in his vehicle in the early races versus the footage that you chose for the final race. How difficult was it to find that footage? Because the contrast is amazing.
In terms of technically or in terms of the shots?
The shots. I mean, because there's no concentration at all in that last. I mean, the shots that you chose, he looks so thoroughly distracted. Mm. He doesn't look like a racer even getting ready for it.
He should not be driving. No, I mean, this is just the tragedy of that day, that weekend. You know, he looks so troubled. I mean, I've seen a lot of footage of Senna. I've seen thousands of hours. There's only one other race ever where he's not wearing his helmet sitting in the car. I mean, he never, ever sits without his helmet on. And so he's always focused. He knows exactly what he's going to be doing. He's visualizing the race. And there's one race in Monaco that I've seen of him a couple of years before where he's not wearing a helmet. The rest of the time, he comes onto the track with a helmet. He doesn't take it off. So that in itself was different, and it's almost like, you know, he wanted everyone to see. So, I mean, there were about 20 camera people around him by that stage. He's obviously not in the right place. He's not in the right mood to drive. There's a lot troubling him in terms of everything. The weekend, the car, you know, personal, who knows, there's just everything's going on, and it's very sad. And Sid tried. Professor Sid Watkins did talk to him and said, do not drive. But the thing about Senna is he doesn't quit. He drives. That's what he does. His answer to problems is to go even faster, generally, you know. You can see the footage that says it all. Right at the back. Yeah, I mean, the main theories are the ones in the film. Some people still think the car bottomed out because of the tyre pressures, but we've shown the film to a lot of Formula One drivers, and Martin Brundle, who took over Senna's drive in McLaren and who commentates for the BBC now, has looked at saw the film quite early on, seen it a few times, and says when he looks at that in-car footage, the final lap, he hadn't seen that before. For him, that car is handling absolutely perfectly. For him, it's not bottomed out. It's doing exactly what it should do. So for him, it takes away that theory, and he's, you know, a driver. So for him, something happened to the car, and I think it's a mechanical failure, is what happened, which is what caused it to go straight. And then so therefore, the other theory, the main theory, is something happened to the steering. But what's important to clarify is that's what caused the car to go straight. He didn't make a mistake. Some people said at the time he made a mistake. He didn't make a mistake. I think we can discount that. They don't even think of that as a corner. That's taken as a straight. It's taken flat. But what happened was it's a series of events. It's like 10 different things had to happen in exactly the right way to cause that accident, to cause him to go straight, to cause the front right tyre to come off, for it to spin, and for the suspension arm to pierce his helmet. You know, no other bones broken, no bruising, nothing else. He should have walked away from the accident. It was just the one, you know. Yeah. So if you believe in God, it's an act of God. If you don't, it's very, very bad luck, you know. But everything had to happen exactly in a certain way for that to have happened. Yeah.
So you said you've watched thousands of hours of footage of Senna's life. Is there anything that came out to you or that you noticed that you think is unique that someone like the press or us as fans of Formula One wouldn't know?
I mean, I think, well, in a way, that's why we made the film. We made the film to try and sum up what we saw of him. I mean, there's a lot more material that wouldn't be richer if we could make the film longer. You know, there's stuff like 1989, the drivers' meeting. This is like a few hours before they're about to race for the World Championship. You know the one where Bellesse says, you know, people are looking at you, they think mistakenly that you're an example, that one. The longer version of that scene, there's a French driver a few weeks before that had a terrible accident. Did Jacques Lafitte or something?
There's
a young French guy who had a terrible accident, career threatening. So Bellesse says, I'm looking to raise money for him because his career may be, you know. So I want you to all give $1,000 and the teams give $1,000 and whatever, you know, I'll give $1,000 and we'll give him some money. And everyone goes, up. And Senna being Senna, the only one who says, hold on, what's he going to do with that? What's that? That's nothing. I'll give $10,000. We'll all give $10,000. All of the drivers give $10,000. And whatever we give, you double from all the fines you've taken off us this season. And everyone agreed. And then he goes, no, it's not my money, I cannot do this. And they start arguing, right? This is like hours before he's about to race for the world championship. Alain doesn't say anything, no one else says anything, but Senna argues with Vallès for a long, long time. And I find it amazing because he's not like sitting there absolutely worried about this is how I'm going to drive the race. He's sitting there worried about a young French driver whose career may be over. They then drive. We know what happens. For me, Prost turns into him. Senna goes on, wins the race, gets disqualified, da-da-da-da-da. When he then gets a suspended sentence, okay, 6 months his license taken away, and he gets fined $100,000. But the next sentence, Vallès says, now I'm going to give half of this money to this young French driver that I've decided to create a fund. So instead of taking a grand off of Senna, he takes $50,000 off of him and pays for the fund. So that was a long version of that scene, okay, which we just don't have time for. But that was summed up Senna. Even at the most kind of point when he should be concentrating, how many sports people who are really, really good at what they do, can you imagine who would do that? At that moment in time, start worrying about someone else. But that kind of stuff, I kept seeing footage like that. And that was what made him so interesting, because of the reputation of being a tough guy on the track, you know, causing more accidents. Jack Stewart, you should know what Stewart says. And yet on the other side, you have the other guy that a lot of the drivers knew, which was the one that was worrying about everyone. And I think the more and more I saw of that, the more and more I thought it made him special, actually, and very different.
Yeah.
Oh, no,
you
would.
So many of the drivers today say that Senna is the greatest driver. Many people in general believe Senna was the greatest driver of all time. There's a noticeable lack of these points being mentioned in the movie. Was that a conscious decision, or were people just not asking that question at that time? Or is it a case of basically the way he died basically saturated?
No, we had lots of footage of that at the time. We just chose not to get into that. That's not really the kind of film we're trying to make about whether or not everyone says he was the greatest of all time or not. Because, you know, if he would, you know, it depends. People say he is the greatest, then you have other people that say, yeah, but you can't compare different eras, you know, there were great drivers at different times. And then if you bring us to stats, then you can say, well, yeah, but Schumacher broke almost every single one, and so he must be in. So we just thought, we're not even going to go there. We're just going to show you what he was like during his life and what he was amazing at. Now, if you ask any drivers, they're all going to say Senna, right? Especially the new ones, the young drivers, because he was their hero. He's the guy that they saw. He's the one that they know about. But, you know, it's impossible to compare Clark and all these other drivers. You know? So we just chose not to get into that. It's not really the point of this film. There's too many kind of TV versions of this that have already been done where they interview everyone, and we just chose not to do it that way.
Yeah. He seemed like he got involved with like the regulations and whatnot. And when they first showed, you know, the stabilizing parts of the car, the computers were doing the work, it seemed like he didn't like that. Was he at all instrumental in what wound up getting them banned?
He wasn't happy when the Williams technology started to take over, yeah. I mean, there's more interviews that we've seen, there's a longer version. Because he just thinks it's bad. For him, you know, if you're a good driver, then you should be the good driver. And if it suddenly means the technology evens it up so much to the point where, you know, anyone who drives a Formula One car is obviously brilliant, okay? But, you know, there are some that are more brilliant than others, maybe. And he just felt that you evened it up too much. You could put anyone in the car and they'll win. And basically, people started switching off. That was the main reason the rules changed. Not because of him. He was one of the few that was saying this isn't particularly good for the sport. But the main thing is that the authorities at the time, it was Max Mosley who made the decision. Because, you know, Mansell won in 92, halfway through the season. The title was over. And in 93, Senna won 5 races that year. So he kept it alive longer than people thought because he was so brilliant. That was, like, people say it was his best year. But people were switching off. So that's why they decided to change the rules. But that's a constant thing in Formula One, as you would know. You know, they change the rules every year, mid-season. How many sports change the rules mid-season? But, you know, if it's getting too much one way, okay, we'll change that. That's now banned. And, oh no, it's not anymore. Is it? Is, oh. So that's just the nature of the sport. He always has been. You know, he wasn't happy about it, obviously. Yeah.
So as a director of dramas, obviously, you're used to kind of working with actors and bending them to your will and tricking them into doing what you want them to do. How is it for you directing without actors, just with stock?
It's amazing. Yeah. Well, when you've got a guy like Senna, though, then you're, you know, when you've got a lead character like Ayrton, then it's not a bad thing, actually, I have to say. You know, there are times when it's great to be on set and to have all of these issues to deal with. There are other times when it's great just to be dealing with post-production and just to be editing. And so, yeah, it was an interesting thing because it was very different an experience. It was like being, for me, it was just the luckiest job ever to have these dailies in a way to deal with, you know, this much footage and to have a character like that. I just didn't know how much existed. I didn't realize how much of that was out there until we started making a film. And it was a really interesting, very difficult, a similar principles, very all the same rules that you have in drama at play here, because a film, essentially, even though it's a documentary, we thought of it almost as a drama. His life story, his kind of three-act structure of the beginning, the young guy coming into the sport, working his way up, winning the first world championship, the middle being the ups and downs of the rivalry, and then we slow time down when he gets to Williams and Imola, like this final act. It just seemed to play like a fiction film. So it was essentially a lot of the rules that you had in a drama. Yeah.
Were you able to find the last seconds of the final lap? I don't think you'd have been able to. But having seen a lot of footage, was that consistent? Because there is a lot of talk that, you know, the last seconds were deliberately missing. Was it consistent with all the other footage that you saw?
I mean, a lot of people say they've seen more. I haven't. What you see is what we saw. In the actual archive, when we asked for that shot, you know, we thought we'd be told it doesn't exist. But what you see is that final lap, and just the very last frame. Then after that, it goes to black. So now what we've been told is that the TV director had so many cameras, could only record certain ones at a certain time. At that point, because the shot was breaking up so much, flicked to the shot behind, which is from Schumacher's car, which is how most people saw it on TV live, was from behind, and Senna's car veers off. So that's what we were told, that there is no more footage. You know, as you know, and as we all know, people say they've seen more. I honestly haven't. So I don't know if that exists or not. And if it did, then, you know why it's not there. Who knows? I haven't seen it. That's the last frame we saw in the actual archive. Right in the middle.
And now let's go right to the wrap-up. San Francisco Formula One group. They meet, they drink, and they have a great time during the Formula One season. Check them out at sff1.com. Cameron Karting is proud to organize and support the 2011 Redline Oil Karting Championship. Cameron Karting offers CRG karts, engines and parts for all karts, engine service, driver coaching, and trackside support to Northern California karters. For more information, contact CameronKarting.com. I want to mention our Facebook and Twitter sites. Just do a search for F1 Weekly and make us a friend or simply like us. If you'd like to advertise or cross-promote with our website or podcast, email me at info@f1weekly.com. I want to thank everybody who listens to the program. Good night.
Good night.
Bye-bye.
This is Desiree for f1weekly.com, thanking you, the subscribers and members of our listening audience, for listening to our podcast, reporting and commenting on Formula One, the highest echelon of motorsport. A blend of technology, tradition, glamour, and guts, all wrapped up in a high-speed package. That's F1Weekly.com for all your Formula One needs.